Talent is an obvious necessity to succeed as an artist, but it might not be enough if no one you respect is there to offer advice and words of encouragement. In Mentors, Muses, and Monsters, 30 writers on the people who changed their lives, contemporary authors from Alexander Chi to ZZ Packer reflect on the ways that their literary influences have shaped and are still shaping their work. This collection of essays is edited by Elizabeth Benedict, the author of 5 novels, including the bestseller Almost and the National Book Award finalist Slow Dancing. She joins us now along with 2 of her contributors, Lily Tuck, whose 4 novels include the 2004 National Book Award winner, The News from Paraguay, and Sigrid Nunez, author of 5 novels and a recipient of the Rome Prize Fellowship. Mentors, Muses, and Monsters is published by Free Press. I'm very pleased that it brings all 3 of these wonderful writers back to our show. It's good to see you again.
Good to be here.
Elizabeth, did thinking about your own story lead you to come up with the idea for this book?
It did indeed. I had the good fortune to study writing at Barnard in the 1970s with Elizabeth Hardwick. And when she died at the end of 2007, Tin House Magazine invited me to write a remembrance of her. And I finished the remembrance about 3 months later. And the very night I finished it and sent it in, I was wandering around my apartment feeling very content and unusually content, and I was trying to figure out why. And I realized how pleasing it had been to remember myself at a time in my life when I wasn't sure what was going to happen to me and who I was, but when I had a certain kind of ambition, and that an ambition that Elizabeth Hardwick helped foster.
Well, what did she do specifically? Did she give you technical advice about writing, or was it the validation of having her approve of your work?
Yes, it was the validation. She didn't give me a lot of technical advice. Her only technical advice, in fact, her only advice was just to read. And she said, the only thing I can do is suggest books for you to read. I can't really do anything else for you. And so there wasn't much technical advice, but that was the best advice anyone can give anyone. But the fact that she liked my work and that she said to me, I think you can do the work. And coming from Elizabeth Hardwick, that was sort of like saying it was a benediction. I didn't need much more. And it really kept me going for the next 8 years when I was writing my first novel.
Well, didn't you find yourself as intrigued by her personal life as by her work?
Well, I did. I first learned about her at a professor's house where I was babysitting, and soon after her marriage ended to Robert Lowell, and the professors and their wives were talking about this incident, and that was my first exposure to her. And so that's how I learned who she was, and then I came to know her work, and then I realized that she was teaching across the street at Barnard, where I was a student, and that I could actually study with her.
When you were compiling this book, did you find that it was common for writers to develop personal relationships with their mentors? Or was it usually a more formal kind of thing?
Well, I think it covered the spectrum. I mean, from writers who became very close to their mentors, Mary Gordon writes about having a lifelong relationship with Elizabeth Hardwick, to writers who didn't write about people they knew at all, but who were influenced by a book they read at a certain time in their lives. Or to a writer who was influenced, say, by going to Breadloaf Writers' Conference. So when I asked people to write these essays, I got an amazing variety of responses, and I decided that they were all so interesting, I sort of wanted to expand the definition of what a mentor is.
Well, Sigrid, you write about your relationship with Susan Sontag, which must have been very personal because you were actually living in the same house.
Yes, I was. It was an unusual situation because I was not a student of Susan Sontag's, and I was not a protege of hers. I mean, she didn't choose me. It was not my work that got her attention. She was not trying to promote my career in any way.
You were involved with her son.
Yes, yes. I was involved with her son, and he was at that time living with her, and we all ended up living together in the same apartment at 340 Riverside Drive. But to be part of any group around Susan, she was a natural mentor. She wanted, in a way that I've never seen with anyone else before, to share all of her enthusiasms and to teach all the time. I mean, she was always on in that way.
Although you say she hated teaching.
She
had come to prominence as a teacher at Columbia, teaching religion.
Yes, but that was one of her pieces of advice, teach as little as possible. She said many times, I've seen some of the best writers of my generation destroyed by teaching. She thought that the academic life and the writing life were at odds. But she had had some wonderful teachers herself, and she was always giving them credit. But she really was a natural mentor.
Although she could also, I knew her slightly, and I found her to be a rather difficult person at times. And I wonder when your mentor can be full of praise one day and then say the nastiest thing the next, how that applies.
Well,
maybe she never did that to you, Sigrid.
No. Well, and also the unusual situation with when your mentor is your mother-in-law. It was an unusual situation, but the thing is, though, that as far as the mentor situation, because she was so broad and really had so much interest in so many other things and then this passion for sharing, I ended up having an enormous amount of gratitude towards her because there were so many things. I was in my mid-20s. I really knew so little, and she was very... she was very kind about that. She wasn't critical of that.
Incredibly well-read and also went to a lot of movies.
Yes, and that was the thing, and as soon as she found out, oh, you've never seen an Ozu movie, then it was very, very important that you get to do that, And people would come to see her, and they would leave with a reading list, or the phone would ring somebody, I'd pick it up, and they'd say, this is so-and-so, I'm calling for Susan, I want to pick her brain. So, I mean, she was an incredible resource and very generous with sharing everything that she knew.
Did you stay in contact with her after you ended your relationship with her son, David Reed?
I did for a while. I wasn't in touch with her or him, and then I ran into her somewhere and started to see her some more for a couple of years.
Lily, your essay is about a writing workshop you took with Gordon Lish, the writer and editor, and he has had an impact. He had an impact on a lot of people's lives. Amy Hempel and I recently talked about how important he was to her career as a mentor.
Right.
But he's a writing teacher. Is a writing teacher a mentor?
Well, I think yes. I think writing teacher and mentor can be one and the same. I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well,
by
you're
your
in
question.
A large class.
Right,
it's not
right.
The same thing as, in the case of Sigrid, living in the same house,
right.
But also, or just socializing with Elizabeth Hardwick, you're in a class with a lot of other students.
Right, but the classes were very, very intense. They were, at the time, I took the first class with Gordon in 1989, the same year I quit smoking, as I write in my essay.
And so that's an important year.
Yes, it was a very important year. The classes at the time were fairly well known. They were considered private workshops, although there was nothing particularly private about them. He gave them in somebody's apartment. There were 12 sessions, and they lasted for 6 hours. And I'll never forget the first session. Gordon talked for 6 hours nonstop, never once pausing to take a breath. And he really inspired people. He was a very demanding teacher, I think. I think a lot of people were not prepared to have him be so demanding and to pay such attention to language. I mean, I think that was the one, not the one, but one of the many things I learned from him was to pay attention word for word to sentences. And not to contradict what Liz said, but I think a lot of people were in there for encouragement or to have their work validated, and Gordon wasn't interested in doing that. And so a lot of people felt very disappointed and very bitter, and some of them were quite furious.
In your essay, we get a sense of the competition that exists among aspiring writers, and that's the sort of thing that would happen in a class where not everybody was encouraged.
Well, it depended. I think Gordon was the judge of who had merit at the time and who didn't. So, yes, there were some people that he raised, that he encouraged more than others. Not encouraged, that's not the right word, but whom he praised.
Well, do you think that some people quit because they didn't get the praise?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Elizabeth Hardwick told you that choosing to be a writer was choosing a hard life. And I'm going to throw this out to all of you. Has that turned out to be true?
I think it is a hard life, but for me, I keep saying the same thing. It's very hard to write, but it's even harder not to be writing. So it's...
Yeah, I think it's a hard life. But I also studied with Elizabeth Hardwick, as Elizabeth did when I was a Barnett student. And that is actually something she would emphasize. It's a very hard life, and even she would say, only half jokingly, it's really not a life, no life for a girl. And she also had this idea that that it was very, very important to have a family, to have children, and so on, and for happiness. Susan certainly thought that it was hard, but she also had this idea that it was the only life, you know, reading and writing, the only life that was really worth living, and she wanted to encourage you to put everything into it and not worry about what the hardness of it.
Now, why is it a hard life? In the case of Susan Sontag or Elizabeth Hardwick, they had fame and great success. Is it that you just work alone all the time, or even when you're at the top of the game, do you still worry about whether your next thing is going to be accepted?
Well, I think that it's hard for us to think about maybe Sontag and Hardwick as they were living their lives, but I had a tutorial with Elizabeth Hardwick, and I would sit in her office every 2 weeks for, I don't know, half an hour, and she would talk about not having any money. And I think that is a theme with writers and how you're going to...
Despite having Robert Lowell as an ex-husband... I would have thought some money would have come in.
Well, you know, I'm not the person to talk about her divorce settlement, but those were the things she said. Mm-hmm. And so I think you have to really believe that writers do have a hard time making ends meet, and that is something that is very true, and it has to do with the uncertainty of writing, with the fickleness of publishing, with... the demands of the marketplace that writing really has nothing to do with, but that you're a part of if you're a writer.
Well, I would think all artists face that problem, whether you're a writer or a painter or somebody does dance, whatever. It's always rough, and most people teach, and only the rare few achieve the kind of economic independence that would make your life a little easier.
Right, right.
And also, something else that makes it hard is the uncertainty of what you're producing and the fear and the self-doubt. And I teach, and I think students have a hard time believing that I feel the same self-doubt that they do. I feel it in a different, there's a different texture to it when I feel it at this point in my life, but I feel it very strongly, and I think all writers do, and I think you're not sure what you're doing and when you'll know and how it's going to turn out and whether anyone will notice. It's extremely difficult.
My guests are Elizabeth Benedict, Lily Tuck, and Sigrid Nunez, three of the writers. Well, in the case of Elizabeth Benedict, also the editor of a book called Mentors, Muses, and Monsters, 30 Writers on the People Who Changed Their Lives. It's published by Free Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Elizabeth Benedict, Sigrid Nunez, and Lily Tuck talking about a book called Mentors, Muses, and Monsters, 30 Writers on the People Who Changed Their Lives. And some of the other writers include Jay Cantor, Maud Casey, Michael Cunningham, Jonathan Safran Foer, Mary Gordon, Joyce Carol Oates, ZZ Packer, Karis Phillips, Carolyn C., Edmund White. So you spoke to a wide range. When you sent out your request, Elizabeth, did everybody say, gee, I want to respond? Or
not everyone,
but a
lot of
reluctance.
No, there was a great deal of enthusiasm, and that was one of the amazing joys of doing this book. I had the idea after I wrote my piece about Hardwick that I was looking to see if there was a book about writers and their mentors, because I had such a wonderful experience writing this essay. And when I saw that there wasn't a book, I decided to try to put this book together. And the first person I asked, once I had the idea and the title, was Mary Gordon. And I think she said yes before I was finished saying it. And then
Do you think that writers have thought a lot about this and felt that they wanted to thank the person who had that influence? Although you also have the word monsters in your in your title.
I think a lot of writers were thrilled for the chance to put their thoughts together about such these important people in their lives. I mean, I was really bowled over by the enthusiasm that people felt. I also included the word monsters because I didn't want to go into the book with the idea that I only wanted fawning tributes to people. I think that the tributes that are in the book are not fawning at all. I think they're complicated and nuanced and very profound. But I also wanted people to realize that they could write about a darker influence, and I thought that would give the book a kind of depth that just having tributes didn't give it.
Haven't all of you also taught? Lily, do you teach?
I don't officially teach, but in the summer I go to this little island in Maine where there is a regular school. It's from kindergarten all the way through 12. And this fall I stayed up and taught a creative writing class to the high school kids, and it was great. Yeah.
But have other writers approached you about doing, being a mentor of some sort or another? Sometimes I'll read a blurb and know, gee, this is a teacher-student relationship.
Right, right. I can't say I've been approached a whole lot, and I basically am a fairly solitary person, and I feel I'm always very inarticulate, and I don't feel that I would make a great teacher, although I had this great experience on this island in Maine because the kids were so great and respectful. And
Sigrid, have you done mentoring?
Well, I've taught. I do teach. I teach, as Susan suggested, as little as possible, but I do it. And so at this point, I've had a lot of students. I've taught in very many different places. Whether I like it or not depends, of course, on the students. In some cases, I enjoy it a lot, and I feel like I'm making real progress. But I do discourage anyone who tries to make a mentor of a specific kind of me, because I don't feel comfortable in the relationship. But I'm still in touch with students I taught, years ago, but I think of them more as friends. I don't think of myself as their mentor. Whatever help I might give or advice, I don't see myself that way.
Elizabeth, well, you had a role model, Elizabeth Hardwick. Do you keep her in mind when you're in a situation where somebody might look to you for advice?
I don't keep her in mind as much as some of the other people who've helped me and who continue to help me. And a lot of the people in Mentors, Muses, and Monsters are people I have taught with or whose books have meant a lot to me. And I keep a lot of them in mind. And I do keep in mind Hardwick's mantra that the only thing I can do for you is to give you books to read. But I also realize how much more I do for students, and I know Sigrid does for students. I mean, I don't think we sit and just hand out books to read. I think we're much more hands-on involved, and I think teaching writing has evolved a great deal since I was studying with Hardwick. But I do feel that I work with students very closely at different times, depending on what it is they need. And I've taught for 25 years, so I've had a lot of experience with students, seeing them over many years of involvement.
Your mentor has passed away.
Yes.
And Sigrid, you two mentors, because you mentioned Hardwick as well.
Yes.
And Susan Sontag. Gordon Lish still with us?
Yes, absolutely. I actually live not far from him, so sometimes I run into him in the street. And after I wrote...
Does he remember you?
Oh, yes. very, oh, absolutely.
He must take pride in the fact that you've done so well. I wonder whether mentors say, well, gee, she would be nothing if she hadn't taken my class.
I don't know. I mean, I think Gordon is very, very special. I always send him my work. I actually showed him this piece before it was published so that he wouldn't object to anything. And the one thing he objected at one point, I said that he was wearing a green T-shirt. And he said he would never, never wear a green T-shirt, so we got rid of the green T-shirt. The other thing that made me laugh a lot was the last book that I wrote, Woman of Rome, The Life of Elsa Morante. I sent that to him, and he sent me back a postcard saying, thanks for the lowdown on Morante. And it still makes me laugh out loud. After 4 years of work, somebody saying lowdown. So he's very funny. I mean, he is very funny.
I'm not sure that is the thing I'd want my mentor to say. But what about the mentors? There's a novel that unfortunately I'm blanking out on the name of the author about writing workshops and mentors, and he talked about the different kinds of rules that different people applied in writing workshops. You know, like the ones who say, yes, you can tell as well as show. Or, you know, I don't want to hear that in my class. Did the people who you were mentored by or whatever, who had that influence on you, say things that you continue to apply when you're writing? Do you hear that voice in the back of your head?
Yes, actually, with me more with Elizabeth Hardwick than with Susan, because, as I say, with Susan, it wasn't really about my writing. But there are these things. For example, when I saw Elizabeth Hardwick once, and I said, "Well, I want to write." This was about my first book. I want to write about my parents, but how can I write about that? It will be so difficult. And she said, "Well, the thing is that you have to find the right tone, and if you find the right tone, you can write about anything." And she was absolutely right. Now, she couldn't tell me how to find the right tone. Nobody can. But I'm always telling that to my students. You do know when you have it. But it is really about that. And it was a wonderful, apt thing to say. And she said many things like that. And I remember them always.
Well, Gordon Lish told you, Lily, not to use too many adjectives. And he also said English is a language of nouns, a naming language.
Yes, he did say that. I was going to say Tom Mellon said that, but that's not true. Yes, and he said not to use adverbs. I'm trying to think what else he said.
Not to use adverbs? That would really limit one, wouldn't it?
Not really, if you put pressure on the verbs and the nouns.
So do you apply those rules to yourself?
I do. Yeah.
Sigrid?
Well, this thing about not using adjectives, and I remember reading that in Lily's essay. Of course, Elizabeth Hardwick used adjectives wonderfully, and as a matter of fact, Susan Sontag, to tie all this together, called her the queen of adjectives and wished that she, too, could use adjectives in the brilliant way that Elizabeth Hardwick did.
Well, I remember hearing an interview with William Styron many years ago in which the interviewer asks him about a manuscript going from 700 pages to 500 pages or something like that. And he said, did you cut out any really interesting scenes that I might want to know about? And Styron said, no, just adverbs and adjectives.
there's a wonderful essay in the book by Alexander Chee about studying with Annie Dillard. And Annie Dillard lays out a lot of rules, and one of them is not to use adverbs. And Edmund White, another contributor, read that essay and called me up and said, I learned so much about writing, I'm never going to use an adverb again.
Do certain mentors turn up again and again? We've mentioned Lish with a couple of writers and Hardwick with a couple of writers.
Let me think. I think those...
Because I would think certain people fall into the mentoring mode a lot easier than others.
Well, I think that there are some well-known teachers. George Garrett taught for many years at UVA, and I went to a tribute of him. And, I mean, there were just dozens of people who talked about how he paid more attention to other people's work than to his own. And so I think if you're in a teaching position and you have a permanent teaching job, that you are in a position to be a mentor. And I think the people who are currently teaching will be hearing from their students in the next decades.
Well, many people have told me Leonard Michels was an important figure in their lives.
Yes, I've heard that, and I actually, he was a tiny bit of a mentor for me. I met him through Susan, and I had started sending him some work, and then he was actually got my first story published in the Three Penny Review.
Well, you mentioned, Elizabeth, that some writers had no mentors. Mm-hmm. How did they get by?
Well, it's interesting. I asked Joyce Carol Oates to be part of this book, and her first response was, I didn't have a mentor. I had many teachers, but I never had a mentor. The people I consider my mentors are writers like Emily Dickinson and Ernest Hemingway. And I said, well, that it would be great to write about that. And she wrote about that, and she also wrote about the importance of Alice in Wonderland in her life. Other writers wrote about other books. So I think the question is, do writers need mentors? And I think that they need some kind of model or some kind of encouragement or some kind of idea that they can do this. And the frontispiece on my book is a quote from Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who talks about the night he read The Metamorphosis by Kafka, and just reading the first sentence about this man waking up and realizing he was a bug, he said, I never knew you could do that with writing, and I would have started writing a long time ago if I'd known you could do that. So sometimes all you need is the example of a sentence in a book to give you the idea and to give you permission and to give you the courage that you need.
And some people, of course, cite their parents. Whether their parents were writers or not, if they got that kind of encouragement from their parents, it made it a lot easier for them to pursue something as difficult and as lonely as writing.
Also, I think very often a writer has somebody in their heads for whom they're writing.
Who do you write for, Lily?
Well, besides myself, I write a lot for Roger Angel because he edited some of my stories a long time ago in The New Yorker, and he was such an amazing editor. And he's a neighbor, and I'm very conscious of his presence, although I don't see him very often. And so I think I do write for Roger.
A lot of people talk about the importance of editors in their lives. My guests have been Lily Tuck, Sigrid Nunez, and Elizabeth Benedict, who, along with Mary Gordon, will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on East 86th Street. That's between Lexington and 3rd Avenues. The book, Mentors, Muses, and Monsters, 30 Writers on the People Who Changed Their Lives, from Free Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, we'll get the latest on the UN Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen from Time magazine reporter Brian Walsh. Then Nobel Peace Prize winner Jody Williams discusses why the United States has resisted signing the International Mine Ban Treaty. We'll look into a scientist's efforts to preserve the world's wheat harvest. Also, Sam Stevenson, who discovered Eugene Smith's 4,000 hours of tapes of jazz music, discusses the Jazz Loft Project and the latest on the solar system with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. The Let It Though Pitch Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Alice Castle, Drew Katchen, and Stephanie Bernhardt. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopit, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.